Chapter 31. Giving the Three Jewels a Final Polish. In accepting the Sangha Trust's invitation to spend a few months in England, I had stipulated that I should have my mornings free for literary work, just as I did in India when not on tour. That in the event this proved impracticable was not the Trust's fault. It was not anybody's fault. So much was there to be done, almost from the very day of my arrival, that for upwards of a year there was no question of my ever having time to produce anything more than a short article or book review. Not that I really minded this. To borrow an image from Santideva, I was no less happy to meet the demands of the new situation than the tusker is to plunge in hot weather into the next pool he comes across. Since Francoise's appearance on the scene towards the end of November, and Terry's giving up his job and moving to a bigger flat, there had been a change. I now had more time to myself, which meant I had more time for writing. They consequently appeared in the April 1966 issue of The Buddhist, under the heading Venerable Stavira's Literary Work, the following item of Vihara News. Quote, "Since the beginning of the year, the Venerable Stavira Sangharakshita has been devoting himself to literary work. Last month he completed The Three Jewels, an introduction to the study of Buddhism, the greater part of which was written before he left Kalimpong, but which had to be laid aside owing to the great pressure of lectures and other work, particularly the reorganisation of the Vihara activities. During the last 2 or 3 months, he has, therefore, been less available at the Vihara for personal interviews than previously, but it is hoped that through the written word he will be able to reach a larger number of people than through the spoken word. The Three Jewels will be published by Ryder before the end of the year. The Venerable Stavira has also revised his well-known work, A Survey of Buddhism, the third edition of which is now in the press. The Three Jewels was not published before the end of the year. It did not come out until the beginning of 1968. And the third edition of the survey, the black and red dust jacket of which had been designed by Terry and printed in England, remained in the press in Bangalore for many more months. So far as I remember, I completed the Three Jewels at that time only in the sense that it was then that I gave the work a final polish, checked my references and wrote a preface, all the actual writing having been done in Kalimpong. Though The Buddhist did not mention the fact, I had a third work in the pipeline. This was the work that was eventually published in 1985 as The Eternal Legacy, an introduction to the canonical literature of Buddhism. In a sense, it was a continuation of The Three Jewels, with which, together with three other works, one partly written and two as yet unwritten, it was to form part of a projected 5-part series entitled The Heritage of Buddhism, a series I was never able to complete. Since I was not expecting to be away from Kalimpong for more than 4 months, I had left the manuscript of The Word of the Buddha, as The Eternal Legacy was originally called, in a cupboard in my hillside hermitage. But 4 months had become 6, and 6 a whole year, and as it now seemed likely that I would be staying in England indefinitely, I had arranged for the manuscript to be retrieved from my cupboard and sent to me at the Vihara, where Francoise was currently typing it for me. The business of giving the Three Jewels a final polish and checking my references must have been both laborious and time-consuming, for apart from the preface, I did not, I think, do any original writing during the months to which the item in The Buddhist referred, or indeed for a long time afterwards. I did not even write fresh editorials for the Sangha Association's little monthly journal, which I was still editing, as I had occasionally done before. Instead, I reproduced some of the editorials I'd written 14 or 15 years earlier for Stepping Stones, the little monthly journal of Himalayan religion, culture and education I had published from Kalimpong, which, since they dealt with themes of fundamental Buddhist concern, were as relevant now as they had been then. I also started serialising my essay, The Meaning of Orthodoxy in Buddhism, A Protest, which had first appeared in 1957 in the Buddha Jayanti issue of the quarterly France Assise, and which remains one of the most important literary products of my India period. The essay was a critique of the claim that the Theravada was, quote, certainly the most orthodox school of Buddhism, unquote, and a systematic inquiry into the real nature of orthodoxy. Its appearance in the pages of The Buddhist scandalised a few people, as its appearance in France Assise had done a decade and a half earlier, the more especially as the claim that the Theravada was certainly the most orthodox form of Buddhism had been made by the eminent, if rather dry, Pali scholar Miss I. B. Horner, whose work Adrienne Bennett, herself a Pali scholar, had once characterised in memorable phrase as, quote, the last ounce of dust in desiccation. Maurice Walsh was not exactly scandalised by my essay, but he was perturbed and wrote an article on Orthodoxy and Fundamentalism, which I printed in a subsequent issue of The Buddhist. Though admitting that Miss Horner's remark of several years ago was probably incautious, he also thought that there was a certain amount that could and should be said on the other side. On the whole, his article was sensible and balanced, and there was much in his discussion of some of the points I had raised with which I agreed. He also scored a palpable hit at some students of Mahayana. Though fundamental Buddhist doctrine was found in Mahayana sources, this was not realised because the doctrine was so wrapped up in glorious and extraneous trappings as to become much less noticeable. The result, in his opinion, was that students of Mahayana were often inclined to lick off the jam without swallowing the pill. Limited as my literary activity then was to polishing what I had already written, checking references and reprinting old material, the early months of 1966 were among the least productive of my whole life. I had in fact written very little for the last year or more, and nearly a decade was to pass before I was able to achieve anything like the degree of productivity that I had habitually enjoyed during my days in Kalimpong. In the course of my first 2 years back in England, I produced only one poem, whereas previously few weeks had passed without my writing one or two. That solitary poem of mine was written, or rather composed, in Berkeley Square, as I sat in the little bus waiting for Terry while he transacted some business at his bank. It was spring, and the green shoots that had started to appear on the branches of the aged trees moved me in the way that in Kalimpong I had been moved by the scarlet crowns of the poinsettias, the ink-blue foliage of the pines, and the distant spectacle of the gleaming white masses of the eternal snows. London itself was beautiful that calm, sunlit morning, and for a few moments at least I did not regret that for the time being my lot was cast not among the foothills of the eastern Himalayas, but in the midst of one of the biggest conurbations in the Western world. But productivity is not just literary. Though I was less available for personal interviews than previously, and was devoting myself to literary work, I continued to lecture regularly at the Vihara and at the Buddhist Society, as well as occasionally to groups outside London. And this lecturing activity of mine was in principle no less a way of being productive than was writing itself. It was as though the creative energies that formerly had gone into literary work were now going into the business of lecturing. Besides continuing my fortnightly lectures at the Buddhist Society on Tibetan Buddhism, with the new year I started a new series of Sunday lectures at the Vihara under the general title Introducing Buddhism. Each lecture, I announced, would be self-contained, so that those who for any reason missed any of the lectures need not be afraid of being unable to follow the later ones in the series. Among my February lectures, which, like their predecessors, were very well attended, there was one in particular which, according to a report appearing in the March issue of the Buddhists, gave rise to comment and discussion. This was the lecture on Evolution, Lower and Higher, in which I attempted, for the first time, to situate Buddhism as a spiritual path within a broader evolutionary context. In later years, the idea that the path to enlightenment was also the path of the higher evolution was to play an increasingly important role in my thinking. As I wrote in 1971, summarising my position, quote, "Science revealed how far man had come. This was the lower evolution. Buddhism, as the path, showed how far he still had to go. This was the higher evolution. Though not strictly continuous, the two phases between them constituted the halves of a single process. Science and religion, the lower and the higher evolution, were comprehended in one gigantic sweep."